Yeah, we have just done, I think, just two paragraphs. You see, after dealing with the idea of rebirth and karma in the first two paragraphs, Sri Aurobindo is going to take up another aspect of karma, looking at it from a universal point of view. He says this consequence of rebirth would not follow from the very nature of karma if there were only an all-soul of the universe. For then it would be that which is carrying on in myriads of forms is past working out some present result, spinning yarn of karma for a future weft of consequence. Now you see, right in the beginning we see this point of view that it is not just the question of one all soul which is guiding this karma or conducting this karmic activities. Because if it were that there is only the play of the universal all soul, then what would it happen? What would happen? What would there be? Now this whole paragraph would be an explanation of if we accept that there is only one universal soul or all soul which is really manifesting its own, he uses a word somewhere, its own, you know, as the originator and planning its own way. Well, it is true that there is the all soul or the universal soul which is conducting this karma. But if we concentrate exclusively on this all soul, then of course we have this question of what we will discuss later, the concept of group soul, the concept of the nation soul. All these get justified, but the lacuna there would be, what would happen to the individual? What is his position? So we should not leave everything that it is, there is all soul, it is doing its work and we have nothing to do. So we should not go to that extreme of abandoning our own individual responsibility. But first he will take up the argument that if there were only the all soul, what would happen? It is the all soul which would be the originator, would abear the force of the act, would receive and exhaust or again take up for further uses the returning force of the consequence. Nothing essential would depend on its doing all these things through the same individual mask of its being. For the individual would only be a prolonged moment of the all soul, and what it originated in this moment of its being, which I call myself, might very well produce its results on some other moment of the same being, which from the point of view of my ego would be somebody quite different from and unconnected with myself. You see, what happens here, that nothing essential would depend on its doing all these things through the same individual mask of its being. Because if the all soul would abear the force of the act, would receive and exhaust its planning. Now, if I can give you an example, say if there's an architect building a house. Now, in that house, the architect has the full idea of what the house would be, through what phases he's going to go through. But imagine a mason. He has just come for the day, for the week, for the month, whatever. He does his part of the job, but he is not there to see the total result, because he might be changed, the architect, the contractor might say, now you change this house and go to another site and you start building there. So what we want to see here is the originator, the architect, he knows the result. But the individual masons have no idea what's happening. So the architect uses this individual to build a piece of the wall or piece of the structure, and then gesture of him. But he says, you will not know this house, I know the result. So you see, by the time you know the result of the house, maybe 5 years have gone by, and the mason, when he comes back after 5 years, then he sees the full house, he says, oh, this is the house wherein I participated. But you see, the joy of the participation, he will not see it fully until years after. So that is the example. Now you get back into this, keeping that example in your mind. It says, it is the all soul which would be the originator, would abear the force of the act, would receive and exhaust, or again take up further uses, the returning force of the consequence. And nothing essential would depend on its doing all these things through the same individual mass of its being. So, the same individual, it may not fulfill its plan. And then what happens? You see, the onus of my action is taken away. I say, no, I'm not doing, somebody else is using me as a mason, as an individual for a time, but the result, the onus of my own activities is not on me. And if this sense is lost from karma, that I'm not responsible for my own acts, then you see there could be a completely different mess in the whole understanding. Then all this action that you are doing would have no meaning and purpose. So he says, what it originated in this moment of its being, which I call myself, might very well produce its result on some other moment of the same being, which from the point of view of my ego would be somebody quite different from and unconnected with myself. So this is the plus point and the negative. The plus point is that there is a universal consciousness conducting this world. So it is in a way nice to see that we are only instruments of that collective, of that universal divine. That is the truth. That is the truth. But it is half truth. Because here, in that half truth, what is coming? He says, there would be no injustice, no unreason in which an apparently vicarious reaping of the fruit or suffering of the consequence. For what has a mask, though it be a living and suffering mask, to do these things? And in fact, in the nature of life, in the material universe, a working out of the result of the action of one in the lives of many others, an effect of the individual's action on the group, or the whole is everywhere the law. What I sow in this hour is reaped by my posterity for several generations, and we can call it the karma of the family. Now this is where now we are getting into the, what I said, the positive side of this universal soul. Now you see what happens. The only thing that I said is the importance of the individual is being taken away. But at the same time, what I do, what I, to get back to my, to that question of the example of the mason, you see, if the mason is supposed to make till the window level, he does it. He lays the foundation for the roof. And what work he has done is carried over to the next generation of workers or next group of workers. If the foundation is not laid well, even if the group of workers come next time, they make the wall, it becomes a bad wall because the foundation is not good. So in a way, each one of us has to do his work, but keeping in mind more the group consciousness. You see what Sri Aurobindo called the karma of the family. So whatever we do in the family, what each individual does in the family, all the others have to bear the brunt of the reward, the punishment, or the reward or the punishment. That's why in India we have this idea, very strong idea of the Kula Dharma. And now we have the same Kula Karma. They are interrelated. So we in India, when we had this question of the joint families, we had this very strongly, to the extent, you know, in South India we have got the family names. You know, I am called Vedre, I say V, I don't know what it means. But my family is called the Vedre Ananda Reddy. So Vedri is a family name. So we have come to that extent. Now, whatever these Vedras do, they have to face their own consequence. So, you see, this Kula Dharma or the Kula Karma is now, in at least in South India, I see, it has even gotten a nomenclature, an entity by itself. Now, next we see what the men of today as community of people resolve upon and execute, come back with a blessing or a sword upon the future of their race when they themselves have passed away and are no longer there to rejoice or to suffer. And that we can speak of as the karma of the nation. So similarly, now when you become the bigger image, so it's not just, you know, these little kulas or little communities or these families are doing anything and everything. Because when these kulas come together, it becomes a kind of a village or a city or a community. And what they do, again, has an effect on the national soul, the nation soul. In fact, this is a notion that has been much discussed in Oroville, because they have this international pavilion, and you know, all the pavilions are coming with the national pavilions. So there the mother said that each one represents the nation's soul. Now there's a long debate, what is this nation's soul? What Sri Aurobindo calls here the karma of the nation. Now you see, this nation's soul is built up of this karma, that dharma, the suffering and the joys. And especially Sri Aurobindo says that it is the suffering of a people, of a group of people, that makes up the national, the bondage of the national soul, especially the suffering. Because, you know, he would say, it's a long suffering of a nation, of a people of the country, gives him a greater psychological identity. So he, in this manner, he traces the history of Germany, how Germany was formed, and out of a huge mass of suffering. You see, the Germany before the World War was also a Germany which went through lots and lots of wars, a continuous period of warfare, because all the time they wanted to have a kind of an empire, a German empire. It's not just with Hitler that we have this notion of the German empire, but even before, they had the same notion, and always they suffered the notion of the German empire. So there the people suffered a lot. So here, in fact, I was reading the foundation, there also he would say the same thing. The suffering of a nation is one of the most important factors to bring about a nation's soul. Now, when we speak about the nation's soul, you see, let's just take the parallel line of the individual soul, that all of us individually, we have the soul. Now, what does it mean? You see, we have a soul which has this body, and the body itself is made up of so many different organs. You have the lungs and the liver and the heart and all that. Now in this body, we call it a single body with a name, but the organs are pretty much independent and yet related. The heart is doing its work continuously, the lungs are doing their work, the stomach is doing its work. You know, the brain is doing its work. But all these are held together by this soul. Because the moment the soul leaves the body, all these organs, they fall apart and the body is destroyed, or what we call death. Now, similarly, a nation has got all these organs. And which are these organs? These are the communities. And in the organs that we have in our body, we have the cells. Each organ has a cell, and that cell is the individual in the society. So imagine if some cells go berserk, if they produce too much, if they get diseased, what we call cancer, and those cells, when they spread out, they eat the organ, then they eat the body. Similarly, in a nation, there are these organs made up of different communities, different castes and different religions, different all this. Each time they are bigger and bigger. But in each one of them, the individual is the most important. So again, we come back to the karma of the individual. What does he do? How does he conduct himself? Does he become cancerous? Does he become a devil? Does he become an evil in a community? As it is said, you know, even in a whole big swimming pool, if we have one drop of mercury, the whole swimming pool water gets poisoned. So in that kind of a community, the individual's responsibility is there. It's not that we are there, 2,000 people in the ashram, we are all doing our work. But one drop of a mercury poison somewhere can poison the rest of the swimming pool, which has got such clear, good, medicated water. So that is where the individual dharma and karma comes in. But we're coming back to this question of the nation soul. So this is how a nation also is formed. There is its own soul, it has organs, and it has its individuals. And when all of them are working healthily, then the body is healthy. So, here, that is the meaning here when we get here, when we come to the sentence. He says, what the men of today's community or people resolve upon and execute comes back with a blessing or a sword upon the future of their race when they themselves have passed away and are no longer there to rejoice or to suffer. So, when we speak of the working for the nation, you see, recently I was in much close contact with IGNU people, the Indira Gandhi University. I used to see some of them working from 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. with hardly a break, lunch break. I mean, I have literally seen them go without a lunch break. I mean, the tiffin would be on the tables and they just had a little snack, sometimes 15 minutes in between some time. Then I wondered, why is this man working so much? He's not getting more money for his extra labor. Then we, you know, the Aurobindonians, we have our own philosophy, working for the mother, offering for the mother, we can work more, we can dedicate, all that. But what philosophy does he have? He has no philosophy. Then I asked one of them. He said, sir, we are working for the country. There is no ideology like a spirituality, we call it, you know, integral yoga, this yoga. But when he said, I am working for the country, I was really knocked down. I said, sir, if our country has people like you, we can be really a great country. And he doesn't expect a wee bit, an extra penny for what he's doing. His office is supposed to close at 5 o'clock. But I've sat with that man till 9 p.m. And all the top people, not just one man. There are several of them like that. So at the end, I accosted one of them and I asked him, he said, no, sir. It's a cause for the nation. So that deeply touched me. So these are the things, you see, where we say that when we work, it comes back with a blessing or a sword upon the future of their race. And that is what we can speak of as the karma of the nation. Mankind as a whole too has a karma. What it wrought in its past will shape its future destiny. Individuals seem only to be temporary units of human thought, will, nature, who act according to the compulsion of the soul in humanity and disappear. But the karma of the race which they have helped to form continues through the centuries, the millenniums, the cycles. Well, of that, maybe a nearer example, that humanity is too large a word for us to understand. Perhaps we can next take up the question of culture, an Indian culture, a Chinese culture, the Egyptian culture. You see, what our ancient forefathers, the Pitrus as we call them, the Vedic Pitrus, what they have done, you see, the seeds that they have sown, now it comes to millions, what the Vaishnavas call later on, through centuries, it is those seeds that are working through the civilization called the Indian civilization or our culture. In fact, you see, somewhere Sri Aurobindo, while describing the source of ethics, he says, you see, the whole system of ethics is controlled by one single vision of the eternal. It all depends how you look at the supreme eternal. And that was a magnificent analysis. And that is why, again, I come back to this question of how the Vedic rishis looked at the eternal. Now, he takes the example of the Greeks. He says, they looked at the eternal as beauty. So, immediately their entire culture, their religion, their ethics, their music, their dance, their literature, their poetry, everything is having the sense of balance, of beauty, of aesthetics, of a beautiful harmony. So the whole civilization is guided by the single aspect of the divine beauty, and beauty, divine is an aspect of beauty when we speak of the four aspects of the mother. Now he says, next, Rome, they looked at the divine, the eternal, whatever you want to call, as power. So there it is a military power, it is strength, it is law. So we have this aspect in the Western world of discipline, of analysis, of mind, of mental discipline, and all that, whatever you want to call it. So in the West we have beauty and power. And then he says, take the Chinese. They look at the divine as originator. So imagine that single aspect of that originator now comes down to the whole culture of the great respect for the elders, the respect for the dead who have gone beyond. So you will see in the Chinese culture, this is predominant. They worship their grandfathers who are no more there. Because they always feel, he is my origin. Beyond grandfather, there is another origin. So God is nothing but the origin. So it comes down on a day-to-day level as what? Respecting the elders. And that comes to the level of the juniors in my college when we used to teach. The great respect we commanded is not what that we commanded, we were given. Because the cultural trait. So as a cultural trait, anybody who is elder is given tremendous respect. To the extent, as we would know, if a teacher is sitting like that, no student ever dares to cross in front of me with his or her head high. They would always bow down, lower down, so that they see their head is lower than mine. It's an extreme case, but now I understood, it's not just a question of ethics, it's how the original people looked at it. And now coming to India, he says, we look at the eternal as the transcendent and the one who is within you. So we have these two aspects of the eternal, one who is above, the transcendent, and one who is within. And so he said, between these two now, our entire aesthetics, our value system of aesthetics, is embraces the origin, the Chinese, that's why we have the respect in India, people, bowing down at your feet, and elders are there. I mean, you go to this culture, I don't know, we don't have in South at all, but you go to North, Bengal and Orissa and up there, Punjab, I mean, everybody pile again. That bowing down to touch your feet. I mean, in Bengal and Orissa is sometimes embarrassing. I mean, they even bow down and do an sashtanga pranam. So, that has come as part of the respect for the elders. And this is certain thing which the West will never understand. Not because they is against, or they don't want to. But what I'm facing is that origin, the whole thing, how it seeps into your day-to-day life. So these are certain things, of course, they can go on at a greater end. But Sri Aurobindo says, because India has this vision of the transcendent and the innermost in-guiding divinity, all this originator, the sense of beauty, the sense of spirituality, the sense of God, looking at the other person as God. How does that come? No Western country, no Chinese civilization would ever look at the other person as a form of the divine. Because it's not there in that origin. I'm explaining all this only to help you just understand this single sentence, however it is, but the karma of the race which they have helped to form continues through the centuries, the millenniums, the cycles. You see, this is why what we have in our origin is of such great importance. So today, if you want to really draw A comparison between East and West is not just a cultural comparison, it's not just a cultural synthesis. It's got to be a synthesis or a realization of that experience. So when a Westerner or when a Chinese experience the divine within, then they can see the Indian values clearly. No amount of reading even the foundations of Indian culture or any other book will convince them, because they don't have that experience. But whereas fortunately our Indian vision can understand the West, can understand the Chinese, because of our integral vision and experience of the divine. So we have therefore duty, respect, adults, elders, even our family person, grandfather maybe, sometimes we really consider them as great wise and we take their wisdom and all that. But sometimes there could be some foolish people, but still, as per our Indian custom, nobody disrespects an adult. Although I know he's a crook of a fellow, but still for the sake of it, we say namaste and go. So you see, these are not cultural differences. What I feel is, what we think is a cultural difference. It's not a cultural battle, it's not a cultural war. It is that foundations. So each has its own foundation. So and then the way we are not able to have a balanced vision of life, sense of beauty around us, because we have in our vision this sense of beauty, the outer beauty, the balanced beauty as part, whereas in the West that is a predominant factor. That's why you see the garden, you see the roads, you see the houses, you see the planning, everything marvelous. But here it's part of the many things, so we are not able to balance out our bhakti, our beauty, our discipline. You know, you see the crackers, you see our temples, you see all that. I mean, a tremendous nuisance, you know, people are not able to sleep, they cannot. But we have never considered all this. But in the West, I read somewhere, I think, one fine morning a Westerner had gone to a house in Japan, and next day early morning there's a knock at the door. He opened the door and a Chinese neighbor comes to offer him some big amount of money. He says, "What for?" He says, "Sir, last night I was putting a nail on my door, on my wall. That noise must have disturbed you. I'm very sorry for that. Can I give you some compensation?" In Japan, yeah. So you see, there's sensitivity to the other. But here you have a pataka right on the road and then my wife Deepshika has to shout, "Hey, please don't do." There's completely no sensitivity. So we are lacking somewhere all these things, because we have got too many things to consider and say, no, all this chalta yaar, this pataka, Diwali is my thing, but it's my festival, the other fellow, he can be damned, I don't care. So all these things are not just culture. What I want to insist is, it has become cultural part expressions, but see what is behind is the vision of the eternal, which was given to us by the Vedic people. Why we say Vedas is the roots is because of this. They may not have spoken about Diwali, they may not have spoken about Dasara or anything, but they have spoken about the vision of the eternal, which has seeped into every activity of our country. We may realize it or not, we may be aware of it or not, doesn't matter.